In Kenya's capital Nairobi have killed at least 10 people and injured nearly 70 others. It comes as hundreds of UK holidaymakers are being evacuated from the country following new guidance from the Foreign Office. Victoria Bacon from the Association of British Travel Agents has this advice for people due to go to Kenya.
Basically, if the Foreign Office advises change around that particular area, you're entitled either to a full refund or to an alternative holiday. So any customers that are due to travel within the next week or so should be able to be offered either an alternative arrangement or their money back.
David Cameron says the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war should be published by the end of the year. A string of high-profile figures have raised questions about delays to the report. A five-year-old girl has died after collapsing at a school in Berkshire. It happened at Willowbank Infants near Reading yesterday. Police aren't treating it as suspicious. Another large fine has been handed to one of Britain's big six energy suppliers for mis-selling. The £12 million penalty given to E.ON will be redistributed to affected customers. And FIFA's president has admitted it was a mistake to choose Qatar to host the 2022 World Cup because of the country's intense summer heat. In an interview with a TV station in Switzerland, Sepp Blatter said everyone makes mistakes in life. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm a very welsome Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Alistair Watson. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Sunday Times Rich List is out this weekend, but can the mega-rich hide their wealth, and how much does it cost to get your name removed? Also, another privatisation looms. The Land Registry staff were on strike this week because they say this privatisation will mean sackings for them and extra charges for us. Also this week, we hear about something the European Court called the right to forget. But is this just what George Orwell warned us of in his book 1984, The Ministry of Truth, which can airbrush newspaper articles from history? And a big article in Newsweek International this week about extensive Israeli spying on the United States. Why has it been, the magazine says, mostly hushed up? Is it simply just another example of what somebody has decided? The wrong story? On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 11 degrees Celsius tonight and dry. Very warm, isn't it? First time I've come in without my sweater on, actually, this year. This weekend, highs of 21. Sunny on Saturday, even warmer. And slightly cloudier on Sunday. So if you're out and about this weekend, try and get out tomorrow. Forget the shopping. Get out and enjoy the sun. Next week, highs of 21 degrees Celsius, cloudier with showers at the beginning of the and the end of the week. Sunny, though, midweek next week. Next weekend is the 24th and 25th of May. There's highs of 16 Celsius, temperatures coming down again, sunshine, and those showers are back again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, soon to be the city's Lord Mayor, Alistair Watson. Hi, Alistair, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as I said, is here too. Now, if you pay council tax, then you can vote. Well, we thought we'd beaten the poll tax, but they did it to us anyway. As we go to the polls next Thursday, I'm publishing my list of city slackers tonight. That is the statistics of MPs and councillors who don't want to come on this show, or more often simply don't reply when I phone them and then email them inviting them on. Next week, six of them are standing for re-election, and they are as follows, in alphabetical order of wards, that's regions of the city, from Bishopsworth, Kevin Quartley. There's also Peter Main in Brislington, Philwood, Chris Jackson, Lockleys, Sean Emmett, and Stockwood, David Morris, and also the enigmatic banker I just cannot get hold of at all. That is John Gurlandris from Stoke Bishop. Now, that's three Conservatives, two Lib Dems and one Labour. If I could start by asking you, Alistair, what your thoughts are about this. Because I would have thought if I can't actually get hold of a councillor on the phone or on email, get them to reply, I wonder, you know, what's going on, because surely that's what councillors are there for. They've got to be contactable.
I totally agree. I'm surprised. Whenever you contact me, I always come back to you. I do try and come on this show whenever I can. So I can't really say for the other councillors. I'm very surprised that they don't get back to you and don't speak to you.
But do you think it's fair to call them city slackers? I mean, it's a bit cheeky of me, really. But
Particularly some. I mean, I know that. Perhaps you don't know, but I mean, David Morris is not desperately well. He does have health problems, and I could see that. You know, he could probably have quite an excuse. But I can see your frustration, Tony.
John Galandris, we see him springing around the council chamber, don't we, during full council meetings? Isn't he chief whip or something like that?
He is
our
chief
whip. Quite sprightly.
He is indeed. Yes.
Tell us a bit about him.
John, yes. I mean, you call him a banker. I mean, he's not an investment banker, so he's not on the, you know, he's not getting huge bonuses. I mean, I think the trouble is that everyone sort of sees these, you know, bankers as being, having £1 million bonus every year. But he's certainly not in that side of the banking. He's in the retail banking sector, and very nice chap, actually.
Okay, well, so the City Slackers list, and I'll post it up on the this show's website, which is thisweek.org.uk. Later is Bishopsworth, Kevin Quartley, Brislington West, Peter Main, Philwood, Chris Jackson, Locklees, Sean Emmett, Stockwood, David Morris, and Stoke Bishop, finally, John Galandris. But straight to your hopeful appointment as Lord Mayor, Alistair, because there was a little bit of something called a homophobia row, and you were then selected after that. So can you just tell us what happened there, because for those that haven't caught up with this? Because although you're Lord Mayor-elect, you weren't the Conservative Party's first choice, were you?
We did have a candidate before me, but I'm incredibly pleased to being chosen by our group to be the Lord Mayor, and looking forward to my year immensely. I mean, I think it's a incredible honour to be chosen as Lord Mayor, but I do have to get through the election first, and the good people of Westby-on-Trim do have to return me as their councillor, because you have to be a councillor first before you can be Lord Mayor.
What are your chances, do you think?
We as candidates always get worried, and that gets us out on the streets, it gets us knocking on doors, and I suppose if you were to ask me honestly, I would say that my chances were good, but you just never know. There's always upsets that happen. We've got a UKIP candidate for the first time in Westbury-on-Trim, so what that will do to the vote, who knows.
What does it mean being Lord Mayor?
Being Lord Mayor, it's a fantastic time, because you're the first citizen of Bristol. People invite you. You see parts of Bristol, you see communities, and you meet people that you probably would never come across in your sort of normal work, or even as being a councillor in your own ward. So it's a fantastic opportunity for anybody, and worth taking if you can get it.
Okay, some not such good news now, and that's Bristol MP Charlotte Leslie, and I'm not talking about her in her red swimsuit, which apparently has been circulating around. If anyone wants to look that up, she's facing an investigation over donations. Bristol North West MP Charlotte Leslie is to be investigated by the Parliamentary Commission for Standards after failing to comply with Commons rules on party donations. Full investigation is underway after Ms. Leslie apologised for failing to register donations made to her local Conservative Association. She said she was happily complying with the parliamentary authorities. She told the Bristol Post, "I'm more than happily complying with all of the Commissioner's requests." Now, this is over a donation by some people connected to the Bristol Port Authority.
David Ord, who's
it's a bit naughty, isn't it? I mean, if you're she's been asking questions, for example, about this, and it does smack of that cash for questions scandal from a few years ago.
I think it can be spun that way, but it isn't. I think Charlotte is mortified by this, and actually, if you were to find any MP that never fiddled expenses, that never, in fact, she doesn't claim even what's due to her. I mean, she is so careful. And I mean, I suppose really what this is, it's a slip up. It wasn't money that was ever donated to her or her campaign or anything. It's money that's been donated to the local association, the Conservative Association. Now, obviously, there are links, because Charlotte Leslie is the candidate and is the MP for that association. But it looks to me more like a cock-up than anything else. And it, you know, and give Charlotte her due. She's made absolutely full apology. She's complying with whatever investigations. She certainly, you know, would not have done this if she'd have known and if she'd have done it in time. And it does look like it's just been a bit of a slip up.
It's David Ord Limited, apparently, and First Corporate Shipping, which own the Bristol Port Company, and there's been they've opposed the plans for the barrage, which Charlotte has too. The donations to the Bristol North West Conservative Association totaled £17,000. Ms Leslie also asked a question of a witness at a select committee who had made a donation of £2,500 to her local association. So we'll see where that one goes. Martin, party funding, this comes up regularly, and it does start to look here as if you know, they've basically bought Charlotte on this issue. They're giving her money, they're £17,000, and they're saying, actually, we want you on board with our campaign against the barrage and other things.
Well, not to pick on Charlotte as an individual, it is an issue. Money in politics is a major issue, and of course in the US it's an even bigger issue. The Supreme Court over there has just agreed, it's basically got a Conservative majority now, and they've agreed that any amount of money can be spent on political campaigning by anybody.
But how would you do
with
this?
No transparency
how would you do
at
this?
All.
How would you do this? Because obviously political parties do need to have some money to pay
the
rent, don't they?
I was going to tell a story. When I was working with the Polish Socialist Party in Poland, we were desperate for funding, and we went to meet this Austrian businessman in a hotel in Warsaw who needed a quick permission to build a hotel on the Baltic. And we were in the government at the time, so we could get him a meeting with the minister. So we sat down, discussed getting a meeting with the minister, and he said, and then of course at the end of the meeting, he said, and we've got a local election coming up. He said, of course. And he sort of got his checkbook out, and there was a negotiation about how much he was going to pay. Anyway, we got some money from him, and then we were sitting around chatting, and he said, and of course, once we've built the hotel, you can have your congresses in the hotel, and we can fix girls for you and everything. And at that point, we took the money and left. But I think it's a real problem for all political forces to raise funds. Politicians need money to do things. And then, of course, they get given money by somebody or other, and then, of course, those people expect something back. Of course, in Scandinavia, they've had state funding of political parties for years.
Alistair, what are your thoughts about this, about whether maybe you know, there should be a ban on private people and companies funding political parties, and it should be done some other way?
My own personal view would be that I would like to see some form of state funding for political parties. The problem with it is that that most of the public would not like to see that. They don't want to see their taxes going to a political party. On the other hand, they don't want to see political parties money from businesses.
You could do it following votes, for example. So, you know, if the party was getting a lot of votes, it would get more money. If it was getting hardly any, it would get none.
And there's a problem there, isn't there? Because then a small party would have a lot of trouble raising its profile because they wouldn't get much money. And, you know, there's no good solution to this, but I think, you know, the public will have to make a decision at some stage. They don't like political parties being funded by wealthy individuals, companies, and so forth. On the other hand, they don't want to give political parties any money to do the campaigning, and frankly, political parties do need some money to run their campaigns, and if we didn't, there wouldn't be democracy. So, you know, the whole thing is quite difficult, isn't it? And there is no perfect solution. We've got to look at this, and I think political parties need to grow up a little bit and you know, make the decisions. It's all very easy to say, you know, no, that's rubbish, you know, we don't want that, but you know, what do they want?
Martin,
I think what's really problematic in the US is that there's no transparency now, because the latest people can put money, like the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson, they're basically choosing the Republican lead contenders for the president, and they don't even have to say how much money they've spent or on what. So transparency at the minimum, surely.
Yeah.
Okay, now UK, there's some very good news for the Conservatives this week, and the Lib Dems for the coalition government. UK jobs growth rises at the fastest rate in 43 years. The jobless number has dropped 133,000 to 2.2 million as working population rises to an all-time high of nearly 30.5 million. Unemployment falls to the lowest level in more than 5 years. Number of people in work rose to 30.43 million, a record high, and almost a quarter of a million up on the same period last year. This is in the Daily Telegraph, Martin. Jobs growth between January and March rose to a 43-year high, driving down the unemployment rate to its lowest level in more than 5 years. Number of people in work rose to 30 and a half, just over a million, just over 30 and a half million. Now, Martin, this does look like things are turning around, that we've turned the corner now with the increase in joblessness, difficulty in getting work is actually ending, and we're now starting to see the economy picking up. I mean, we've got the good economic figures, basically, that's picking up too, and the employment figures are also looking very good.
Okay, well, just two points. It says here, self-employment has been a key reason behind both the rise in the number of people in work and the lower jobless rate. Almost one in seven people are now self-employed. People working for themselves has risen by 375,000 over the past year. And the economy is smaller than it was before the crash. It's just about to reach the same size that it was.
Right, so what you're saying there is a lot of this growth is in self-employment.
Is in self-employment.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, I would say that I know several people who are supposedly self-employed claiming working tax credits, but they've basically got 2 or 3 hours work a week. I'm currently claiming unemployment benefits, and I'm considering, because of the restrictions and difficulties of it, of declaring myself as self-employed and claiming working tax credits.
Self-employed as what?
A journalist, I don't know, a commentator, anything.
But you have to be being paid
people can make up something what is happening is that a lot of people are giving up on trying to claim unemployment benefit, and therefore they're becoming self-employed. But the other point I would make is that inevitably and logically, these jobs are low-wage, low-productivity jobs. Because the economy is not quite as big as it was before the crash, but we've got more people employed on paper than ever. That means that productivity per worker has fallen, which means that these jobs are low wage, low skill.
But isn't this just sour grapes? Most of these figures are really good. I mean, actually, most of those people who are self-employed, what they've done is they have gone out and they've started small businesses, you know, working for themselves.
I very much doubt. I think a lot of this self-employment is in fact defensive steps taken by people who don't particularly want to be self-employed, but they haven't really got much of an option. Also, of course, the third point I'd make, and then I'll allow Alistair to jump on the dunghill and crow, is that we're still printing money. We've got zero interest rates and we're still printing money hand over fist. That quantitative easing was only supposed to happen for a few months while the economy sorted it out. We're now 5 years in and the printing press is still running. Ultimately, I agree with free market economists. That can't work. Ultimately, that will crash.
These figures, to what extent would you agree with Martin that there may be some massaging of the statistics, Alistair?
I don't think there's any massaging of the statistics. I think there's stuff behind all this. And I mean, Martin does have somewhat of a point that, you know, some people will be in self-employment who perhaps would like a full-time job. But I have to say that, you know, in my own experience, and I've been in business around the Bristol and the Bath area, all the west of England, there is a boom in enterprise, enterprises being set up, small businesses, small limited companies, and I really think that's great. You know, I think we don't all want to be working in large organisations. I think the state of the economy is getting better. But, you know, I would agree in some ways with Martin that the job isn't done. And I think this is the dilemma for the Conservative Party, if you want a sort of political comment, in that, you know, the Labour Party are looking pretty stupid. But what we don't want to do is crow too much and say everything's finished, because then people relax and they say, oh, we can have these socialists back in and they'll give us loads of money again. And we'll crash the economy yet again. So we have to say to people, the job is not done. There's still a massive debt that we owe. The deficit still isn't cleared, so we're not even sort of eating into that debt yet. So, you know, things are turning around, and I do think it's looking brighter. Prospects are looking brighter, but certainly, you know, the job is nowhere near done yet.
Well, there was a fascinating article I tweeted in the Mirror this week. Stitching up claimants is all part of the job, says Job Centre Insider. This was in the Daily Mirror, 13th of May. What's that, about Tuesday or so? Last week, Ian Duncan Smith met a whistleblower who's worked for his Department for Work and Pensions for more than 20 years. Giving the Secretary of State a dossier of evidence, the former Job Centre Plus advisor told him of a brutal and bullying culture of setting claimants up to fail. The pressure to sanction customers was constant, he said. It led to people being stitched up on a daily basis. The man wishes to be anonymous, but gave his details to Ian Duncan Smith, Department of Work and Pensions Minister Esther McVeigh, and Neil Coulting, head of Job Centre Plus, who also attended the meeting. We were constantly told to agitate the customer and that any engagement with the customer is an opportunity to sanction, he told them. Labour MP Debbie Abrahams, a member of the Department for Work and Pensions Select Committee who set up the meeting, has renewed her call for an inquiry into inappropriate sanctioning. "I'm deeply concerned that sanctions are being used to create the illusion that the government is bringing down unemployment," she said. "Sanctions predate the coalition as a way of ensuring benefit claimants, including the jobless, sick and disabled people on employment support allowance, do attend appointments and apply for jobs. Under the Tory-led government, they've soared up to nearly 1 million a year from the most recent data." Now, I can remember, I mean, when I was claiming unemployment benefit, I was sanctioned too for not turning up, Alistair, to, this is, I mean, it's having your money taken away for 2 weeks, it was, for not turning up to an interview that I hadn't been told about.
I can't comment on specific cases and there's anecdotes and so on. I mean, I think the DWP, you know, it's patchy. It's run by human beings, and some of them do the wrong things, and they should be looked into and sorted out. I mean, I've spoken to somebody in the DWP, senior in the DWP here in Bristol, and they genuinely want to get people back into work, and they're, you know, there are good, caring people in that organisation. They're not all monsters by any stretch. But I don't have any first-hand knowledge myself, and so, you know, I can't say that, you know. I think if you do get a Tory government in, you do get a government which does look more intently at getting people who can work into work and not allowing them to rest on benefits. And I mean, I know some people could say, oh, well, you know, that's tough. But it's, in a way, it's tough love. You know, get people out there, you know, make them get up in the mornings, make them get to interviews. I don't see anything wrong in that, as you know, as long as we aren't bullying people who are, you know, not capable or disabled or whatever.
Martin, this whistleblower claimed that managers fraudulently altered claimants' records, adding managers would change people's appointments without telling them. The appointment wouldn't arrive in time in the post, so they would miss it and then have to be sanctioned. That's fraud. The customer fails to attend, their claim is closed. It's called off flow. They come off the statistics and unemployment has dropped. They're simply being stitched up.
Well, I mean, that in fact is fraud. And if that's what's going on, the people concerned should be punished. But I think the other factor that's going on is that the targets for removing people from the claimant count are definitely being operated. And that's not reasonable. People, whatever the rules are, if people obey those rules, then they should be kept on benefit. And if they're not obeying the rules, then they should be removed from benefit. There shouldn't be targets for removing people from benefit. That's what I think is unfair and unreasonable. And of course, ultimately, I don't believe that in this economic recovery, I don't believe in it at all, as for the reasons I said earlier about quantitative easing. Ultimately, we're going to have to change the way we think about the welfare system, and we might have to think about things like citizens' income, which they're about to have a referendum on in Switzerland.
Well, this whistleblower, Alistair, one more time, I'm afraid, because it's absolutely a fascinating insight to some of the things that go on that very rarely get reported. I particularly remember a well-qualified father. He was desperate to work with a wife and child to support. I was told to agitate him. They said, tell him he's got to apply for factory and labouring jobs. Change his contract. If he doesn't take the jobs, stop his benefit. It was a trap.
I can't comment. I mean, this is the Daily Mirror. I mean, you know, they are peddling a certain political
Well, it's also a real whistleblower who has met with the Secretary of State.
But, you know, that might be one office out of thousands in the country. I don't know. I mean, I do think, like Martin, that it should be investigated. The manager of that office should be brought in. That, you know, that things should be looked at. It obviously, you know, it does sound like some, you know, massaging of statistics, bullying some of the claimants and so on. So, you know,
okay,
needs to be looked through.
Staying on benefits, housing benefit claims are among working people in Bristol shoot up. This is in the Post earlier this week. Housing benefit claims amongst workers across Bristol have shot up by more than half since 2010. New analysis shows the number of working people claiming housing benefits increased by 57% from 5,200 in May 2010 to 8,200 in November 2013. So what's that, over about 2.5 years? Shadow Chief Secretary of Treasury Rachel Reeves said the figures challenged government claims that the country was experiencing an economic recovery. She told the Post, "Most people think that if you go out and work hard, you should be able to put food on the table and pay the bills. What these figures show is that there are a lot of people for whom that's no longer the case. They're having to rely more and more on housing benefit to help them pay the rent." And now, Alistair Watson, Conservative and Westbury on Trim, this is a bit worrying, isn't it? If even you know, many of these people who got new jobs aren't being paid enough to actually pay the rent.
Yeah, I and you can look at these statistics in two ways, can't you? And I'm sure Martin will, you know, as an economist and a statistician, will know that looking at raw numbers like that, you know, it's the story behind them. It's actually what's going on there. I mean, that could be because claimants that we have at the moment are now starting to get jobs, and the incentive is even to do some part-time work where they still require to get some benefit to help them onto that the work. So, you know, they may be coming into the working side of it, but still claiming for some housing benefit. It's difficult to know from the statistics, and you know, if it was that you know, a lot of people who were working now find that their pay has gone down and they're having to claim housing benefit, that would be worrying. But if it's the other way around, it wouldn't be. I think that looking at stats like this and then, you know, making some interpretations of it, you know, from one angle or the other is very dangerous.
But Martin, this is good, isn't it, really? Because it's better that people are not claiming unemployment benefit, only claiming housing benefit, rather than claiming both. And that's what's happening here.
Well, in a way, yes, it is. But I think you've got to accept, therefore, that the government is intervening to subsidise wages. I mean, there's nothing. I'm not a free marketeer. I'm perfectly happy for the government to intervene to subsidise wages. And it's, you know, it's giving people a path to work by giving them a hand. But of course, the reason why the housing benefit bill is so high is because we haven't got enough housing at the relevant price for the people to rent from. We haven't done anything about social housing in this country for a generation, including 13 years of a Labour government, and therefore we're now, the housing benefit bill is spinning out of control, because as the housing boom takes off, rents are going to rise and the housing benefit bill is going to go up. Coming back to the deficit we mentioned earlier, George Osborne has decided that he wasn't going to reduce the deficit in one parliament, he was going to do it over two, which is another reason why the economy started to pick up, because we've stopped banging our head on a brick wall, which is what we were saying all along.
Now, this subject of housing benefit also came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, and here is Alex Cunningham asking a question about it.
Mr. Alex Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There's been a 61% increase in the number of working families claiming housing benefit in the Stockton Borough. Isn't this further proof that the jobs he claims to have created are generally low-paid, part-time and zero-hour contracts, which don't pay enough to meet the rent?
What I can tell him is that in the Stockton North constituency, unemployment has fallen by 23% over the past year. And actually, if he looks at the unemployment figures, he'll see that the number of people in part-time work who want full-time work has actually fallen, as increasingly people are able to find the full-time work that they want. Yes, of course, there is an increase in the number of people in work claiming housing benefit, because there's an increase in the number of people in work. That's what's happening in our country. We're getting the country back to work.
Alistair, how do you think, is it going to be possible to actually get more full-time, well-paid jobs rather than a lot of part-time jobs, so that when people are actually leaving unemployment, they're able to step into a job that can pay the bills?
Oh, yeah, and I think there are lots more full-time, well-paid jobs out there. I mean, you know, the local enterprise partnership in the west of England here in Bristol and Bath, I mean, you know, they're going to be producing another, you know, through the investment that's coming into the area, there's going to be another 6,000 jobs next year. I mean, they're looking at 60,000 jobs over the next 5-6 years. So, you know, jobs are coming in, good, well-paid jobs. People do need the skills to get those jobs, and we're looking at, the supply side of that equation as well, because a lot of the higher skilled jobs, we are having to bring people from outside of the Bristol area. In fact, from outside the UK are coming into this area for those. So what we've really got to do is make sure we've got the skilled workforce to take those good jobs. But they are coming along, and they're starting now.
Martin, this housing benefit bill is going up all the time, though, isn't it? Is there any possibility that it might peak and then start coming down again?
Well, no, because I think what's driving the improvement in the economy is a property bubble. It's the usual situation in Britain. It's not, it'd probably be the same if we had a Labour government, because the economy's been distorted over many years by the property market in the country. Of course, in places like Germany, house prices haven't moved at all in about 40 years. In Britain, we get used to this roller coaster. I think also, as I've said before, coming back to quantitative easing, people have just forgotten that we're printing money, billions every year, to underpin the assets of the wealthy classes. That's what quantitative easing does. If the government wasn't doing that, the market would collapse. And it's not just in Britain. The real problem is in the United States of America, where the Federal Reserve has been printing money like there's no tomorrow. And ultimately, of course, what the Russians are now thinking of doing is getting together with the Chinese and breaking the petrodollar by starting to buy oil or sell oil in rubles, yuan, or something linked to the dollar, linked to gold. At that point, the US market will crash and the British market will go down with it.
Well, Kerry McCarthy, the Bristol East Labour MP, also asked a question on Wednesday about Gary Barlow, who's a Conservative supporter who's doing some kind of tax avoidance scheme.
Kerry McCarthy!
Is there a good reason why the Prime Minister won't condemn the tax affairs of Tory supporting Gary Barlow as morally wrong?
I couldn't have been clearer that I condemn all of these aggressive tax avoidance schemes. And not more than just condemning them, this government has taken action, legislative action, to say to people, to coin a phrase, we want your money back for good.
Take Mr. William Cash!
Martin, what about that? Because, the other thing is David Cameron's father was also quite a pioneer of tax avoidance schemes, taking money offshore after the Thatcher government brought down exchange controls back in 1979-1980.
You've taken the words right out of my mouth. I think the real problem is we were talking earlier about sanctioning people on benefits, but people who have fiddled the LIBOR rate, for example, just one of the egregious things that have gone on, are not even to be punished in any way, shape or form. Ultimately, people are going to get bitter about this. And I think we're moving towards a society, if there is a recovery, what's happening is we're creating a 19th century setup where people will have low-paid, low productivity jobs with no trade union protection, often zero-hours contracts. And even if it's successful, it's not really a pleasant prospect for most of the population. But I don't even think it can be successful.
Alistair, what about this tax avoidance question?
I hate all tax avoidance. And, I think that, 20 years ago, it was kind of just brushed off as being, well, that's what you do.
But
when
why
you get
not tighten up the law? But, party's in government.
Yeah, I'd love to see my party do that. I really like to see it all happen.
Someone says to you, sorry to interrupt you, but if someone says to you, look, the law says you've got to pay this much, but if you do this, you don't have to pay that. I mean, most people are going to not voluntarily pay more tax than they need to.
Indeed, that's right. And I even know people who've gone to live abroad and they only come back to this country for so many days per year. And, you've got Steve Lansdowne out there living out in Jersey, doesn't he? And, I just think it's abhorrent. I think that, if you live in this country and you're wealthy, for God's sake, these people can't even spend this amount of money in their lifetime. I don't know why they're hoarding it, to be honest. I just can't understand it myself.
Any ideas about that? Even if you've got more money than you could ever spend.
Well, I'm glad to hear Alistair say this, because we need to develop a consensus across the board about this.
I think it's immoral. I think it's immoral.
Especially when you're asking people at the bottom to make sacrifices, as we are.
Indeed.
You're either on Team Britain or you're not. Yeah. And if people want to leave the country, what I would say is if you leave the country not to pay your taxes, then you're not coming back, and we're going to take your citizenship and your passport, and your kids will lose it as well, if we're going to get really serious about it.
Well, we're in the midst of election campaign. The actual election takes place next Thursday. Do vote, please, if you can. We always try and advise people to do that here. Even though there may not be a massive difference between the different parties, certainly this is your chance to actually make some difference. That's what this show is all about and why I do things like my City Slackers. But it's worth saying that in the European elections, the actual voting system is different, isn't it? Martin, do you want to just say something about that? Because this is a proportional system.
It is a proportional system, which is why probably one of the reasons why UKIP will probably do quite well, because people realise that it's not a wasted vote. The Greens will do better in the European election than they do at general elections. You should always participate in elections. If you don't, you've got no right to criticise. I mean, unless you, if you're not going to participate in elections, you've got to come up with some other thing that you're doing to improve things. This is a chance for people to have a say. I think it's going to be a rather unusual election because it's basically all about Europe, and it's not going to be like the general election which will follow. But it's going to have implications for the general election which will follow. Politics is as interesting as it's ever been, in my view.
And of course, many of the areas are in Bristol are local wards are being elected, including Alistair here. Alistair, what's your thought though about the electoral system, the first past the post, which we use for general elections here, and the local elections, and the difference between that and the proportional systems which are used for the European elections?
I'm a fan of first past the post. I think it's clear. People know who's won. They're not unsophisticated. They realise that, you know, they could do tactical voting if they wanted to, but they want to vote for the party they want, and the one with the most votes gets in. I think proportional systems make it difficult to know. I mean, I would doubt if there's many people in the southwest could name even one of their MEPs at the moment. You know, there's in fact, I would struggle to name more than four out of the seven. You know, it's tricky. You know, even so, you know, proportional, and it's the whole of the southwest. I mean, we've got, you know, Ashley Fox is our MEP, and you know, he's having to travel to Gibraltar as well because they're included in the southwest. But he's down in Cornwall, in Devon. And,
what about the Falklands? Is that
not quite yet? I don't think.
anyway, also worthwhile to say that there are other parties that haven't been on this show over the last month or so that are standing in the European elections. That's an Independence from Europe, the British National Party, and the English Democrats. Martin, give us a reason to vote, because so many people out there say, well, there's no real difference. The big bankers really run the country, and the city runs things, and most of the parties, if they want to get elected, have got to kowtow to them.
Well, that's very true, and I understand why people might say that, but you're never going to change it by not voting. I think the debates we've been having here this afternoon show that the idea that the parties are all the same is simply fatuous. They're not. There's very big differences of opinion. And I just don't know how this has got hold of the zeitgeist, where people just say they're all the same. I think where it comes from is because it's quite clear that certain forces are beyond political elections. So, for example, if the Federal Reserve messes up and the world economy crashes, what is anybody going to do about it? Alistair as Lord Mayor or the Prime Minister? It's beyond people's control. But I don't think people are going to get anywhere by not voting. Voting is the only thing we've got to try and make the market behave itself. And if people don't vote, then it really will be the market and nothing else.
Okay, thanks, Martin. And 50,000 ambulances have been in queues for over half an hour at accident and emergency. This is a question brought up on Wednesday down in Westminster by one of the MPs. So let's have a listen to that.
Mark Hendrick.
Mr. Speaker, 50,499 ambulances have been waiting in queues of at least half an hour at accident and emergency units up and down the country. What's he going to do about it?
What we are doing about it is making sure that the £12.7 billion extra that we are putting into the NHS, unlike the Labour NHS cut in Wales, is going to good use. And we can actually see in our NHS, we have 1.2 million more people attending accident and emergency. And over this winter period, we met our targets for accident and emergency. I remember the last time the Labour leader raised our hospitals at Prime Minister's questions. It was back in November. He hasn't had a word to say about it since. He predicted a winter crisis. He sat there day after day, dying for it to happen. It didn't happen because we got a strong NHS with more doctors, more nurses serving our country.
Well, quite an amazing job by Mr. Cameron there, turning that question round, Martin. And how do you answer the criticisms? Because he's saying Labour Party cut the NHS in Wales and been making a mess of things. And also, he's also criticising Ed Miliband's technique at Prime Minister's questions. I mean, the last 2 weeks, all of Miliband's questions have been about AstraZeneca. And you wonder, I mean, how many questions can you ask? 8, 9, 10 questions, all about AstraZeneca. He's falling down on the job. Ed Miliband,
well,
isn't
it? Let's pick two things out here. One is about the NHS and the other is about Ed Miliband. So
okay.
Let's just start
one
with
by
NHS.
One. Yeah.
Well, the main thing I would say about the NHS is David Cameron, before the last election, One of his very few explicit promises was that there'd be no top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service. That's certainly not what's happened. The new purchasing system will ultimately open up the NHS to international competition and international competition law. And over time, we will see a gradual dismantling of the service. All of these US companies are circling like vultures to take what they can. But coming back to the Labour government, the previous Labour government, they brought PFI in to build lots and lots of hospitals, which has been absolutely disastrous. But of course, this is what makes people say they're all the same. So Labour Party brings in PFI, which is basically a free market. Well, it's not even free market, it's a free money from the state idea. And then, of course, it's very difficult to argue against it once you've actually done it. And I'm afraid, from my point of view in the Labour Party, I'm very disappointed with some of the things that the last Labour government did. But that still doesn't mean I'm not going to vote.
Alistair, what about... Well, I'll ask you in a minute, Martin, about Miliband and his technique of asking the same question six or seven times. But, Alistair, it's not good, the statistics that he's bringing up there, is it? 5,500 ambulances coming up to the accident emergency with a patient in there, but they're sitting around for half an hour.
I mean, it doesn't sound good. I'm not an expert on NHS statistics. I tell you what, though, I went and had a look around the new hospital in Southmead a couple of weeks ago, and it is absolutely fantastic. Built with PFI money. There's no way we could have built that on the money that the government would have given to the area. It is just a stunning place. I tell you, the ambulances are never going to get held up going in there. Little detail has been thought through. There's plenty of bays for everybody going into accident emergency. I think that's going to be an amazing hospital.
It's a bit worrying, though, isn't it, when I think the guy's name's Liam Nevin. He was in charge of finances up at the North Bristol Trust. As soon as the deal of the PFI is signed and everything is moving, you know, he disappears. So, of course, if there's problems with the PFI, it's not going to come back to his doorstep. And now I think he's at the council, isn't he? He's one of the top lawyers at the council.
Yeah, he's our chief lawyer at the council, Liam Nevin. Yes, indeed. I he's still around, and I think he'd be
at least he's in the city. Yes. So if people got a problem with the PFI, they can come and find him.
I think that now, in the early days of PFI, some of the contracts were a bit loose. People who negotiated them weren't as experienced. I think this contract appears to be very well tied down. I think it's going to be a fantastic facility for the area, and all the PFI schools that were built during the Labour time. I mean, you know, we're sitting in one here at City Academy. You know, they've given our children a fantastic boost as well for the facilities. So, you know, PFI. Okay, you know, you might say, well, it's just like a mortgage. It's we're paying it off. Eventually, those assets will come back into public ownership. So it's a way of leveraging the finances that we need to build these sort of places.
Okay, Martin, back to Ed Miliband, and why does he ask the same question five times, 2 weeks in a row? Surely, you know, he's got 10 opportunities to ask different questions there, but he's asking the same question again and again.
It may surprise you to know, Tony, but I don't actually chat with him privately about what his tactics are at Prime Minister's questions, and I don't suppose he listens to the show on a regular basis. I've no idea why he did it.
Okay,
he will be able to answer the question better.
Well,
than
maybe we'd better email him. I'll say okay. Okay, on to another completely different story. This is Boris Johnson comparing the BBC's inconsistency over the N word to the Nigerian maniacs of Boko Haram. This is a BBC Southwest presenter on Sunday evening, David Lowe, hitting the headlines. It was on the front page of the Daily Mail last weekend. Boris Johnson's claimed that the treatment of BBC DJ who accidentally played a song containing the N word, even though you could hardly hear it, and it was a version from 1930s, was akin to the inconsistency shown by the Nigerian maniacs in Boko Haram. Another thing is that the show was pre-recorded and he'd submitted it to the BBC to listen to before it was played, so surely it was their responsibility, not his. The London mayor said Britain was living in a Boko Haram world in reference to the terrorist network that has kidnapped over 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria. BBC Radio Devon broadcaster David Lowe claims he was forced to quit after playing an 82-year-old version of The Sun Has Got Its Hat On, which featured the racial slur. Johnson said the BBC was a Boko Haram world. Martin, what is going on here? Why is this guy being sacked? He's actually very ill, he's disabled, and he's, even though they've invited him to have his show back, he's been so devastated by the way he's been bullied by the BBC that he said, well, I'll just have to recover first and then we'll see.
Well, I think there is obviously a debate to be had about this. The guy obviously didn't intend to cause any offence, and therefore, you know, maybe he's been unfairly treated. But I think Boris Johnson comparing it to Boko Haram, which is very typical of Boris's style. I mean, if we really are going to get serious about the very serious situation with these girls in Nigeria, let's not drag the BBC into it because it's cheap and silly.
Alistair, did you ever listen to David's show by any chance?
Missed that one.
But anyway, what are your thoughts about the way he's been treated by the BBC? I mean, of course, it's our local, you know, BBC here that's really in charge of the South West Regional Broadcasting.
It seems like an overreaction. I mean, you know, if he'd have used the certain word, you know, or any other racial slur or against any other minorities, you know, that's fair enough. But
because this is the irony pointed out by the Mail here, is that Jeremy Clarkson actually did use the word, and he hasn't. So Jeremy Clarkson's kept his job. Isn't this just simply some sort of BBC, although it's supposed to be public service, making a commercial decision here, saying, oh, well, Jeremy Clarkson's programme sells all around the world, we make a fortune out of it, so he can stay?
I know, it does sound a bit like that. I mean, I don't think, I mean, Jeremy Clarkson as well, he made a full apology and did say, you know, what he was trying to mumble it or pretend, you know, so it, but it wasn't very clever of him. But, you know, that's Jeremy Clarkson for you. He's not one of my favourite broadcasters.
It does remind me, back in I think it was about 2004, BBC Redhead was unfairly sacked. This is when the BBC Regional Broadcasting's Helen Reid, who used to do the request show at the weekends, she was talking about the bullying at the BBC, and eventually she took them to an employment tribunal and was awarded £5,500 in compensation. Martin, don't the BBC, by doing this kind of thing, actually play right into the hands of Rupert Murdoch?
Well, I think that things have moved on in the sense that we're not prepared to tolerate racial slurs in a way that we used to happen a generation ago. But we've got to keep a sense of balance about this. I don't want people to feel that they're not allowed, for example, to have their opinions and what have you. I'll just come back to Boris. I don't think Boris should be bringing Boko Haram into this. Is this Boko or Loco or whatever? Now, this situation in Nigeria, which is developing, and we're trying to work out what's going on, because like many people, it's all new to us. But you shouldn't be mixing these things up. It's too serious for that.
But generally speaking, bullying at the BBC, we've had the human resources boss at the BBC also as I had to leave recently. There was a report into after the Jimmy Savile affair into bullying. It does seem that the culture is rife there. How on earth do you stamp this kind of management culture out?
Well, I'm sure if the BBC, there's bullying in the BBC, there's bullying in lots of organisations, I'm afraid. And in my working life, I've come across it pretty frequently. And it's really difficult to deal with because, you know, there are power imbalances. And I'm afraid our society is a hierarchical society where the people at the bottom have to be submissive to those in charge. And, you know, it takes a lot to change that.
Do you think the BBC still got a role today? Because they're not really doing themselves any favours by this kind of act, are they, Alistair?
No, not at all. And I mean, bullying is in the workplace is unacceptable in any form. And I suppose, you know, again, we need to have those checks and balances, and I don't know why the BBC can't put things in place to make sure this doesn't happen, because human nature means that, you know, these high-achieving, driving people do tend, you know, when they get to those positions of power, do tend to want other people to be like that, and then, you know, can certainly bully people further down the organisation when they've got the power to do it. So, you know, there needs to be checks and balances, and every organisation I worked in, commercial or public sector, you know, we just have to root these people out eventually, and it's you know, we need whistleblowers, we need people who will speak out against it.
Interesting, because they asked David Lowe, they said to you, please will you fall on your sword? Perhaps it's time for some of the senior managers at the BBC that were involved in this case to do the falling on the sword instead.
Absolutely, yeah.
And let's wish David Lowe a very speedy recovery.
Indeed.
Bless him. And hear him back on the airwaves as soon as possible. Now, back to Prime Minister's questions, and this is one that relates to Filton, because another airfield, run in a rather similar manner, it seems, is being sold off down in Kent. Guess what? They're going to build houses all over it. So let's have a listen to that from Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions.
Sir Roger Gale!
Mr. Speaker, at the end of November, Mrs. Anne Gloag, a director of the Stagecoach Company, acquired Manston Airport in my constituency for £1. On Budget Day this year, Mrs. Gloag announced that she was going into consultation with a view to closing an airport, which is worth hundreds of jobs, is a major diversion field and a search and rescue base. Mr. Speaker, since then, my honourable friend the member for South Thanet and I have sought to find a buyer. Last night, the River Oak Company of Connecticut, who already have airport interests, put in an enhanced and realistic offer to keep Manston open, save the jobs and develop the business. At present, the owners are reluctant to negotiate. Mr. Speaker, I don't expect my honourable friend, my right honourable friend, to engage in commercial negotiations. But will he seek to ensure that the CAA operating licence remains open, that Manston remains open, and that further discussions are held, and will he encourage those discussions to take place?
The Prime Minister.
No, well, I know that my honourable friend has been fighting very hard with the honourable member for Thanet South about the future of Manston Airport, and recognised that it has played an important role in the local economy and employed local people. Ultimately, the future of Manston remains the responsibility of the airport owner, but I do think it's important that the government is engaged, and I know my right honourable friend, the Transport Secretary, is engaged. He will be speaking to Mrs. Gloag about this issue and also contacting River Oak, the potential purchasers. In the end, they have to make a commercial decision, but the government will do everything it can to help.
Now, Alistair Watson, Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, soon to be Lord Mayor, we hope, if he gets re-elected. This is not all that far from you, Filton. What are your thoughts about the way... I mean, which side of this are you on? Because the people that own the airfield, they're looking at, well, we can get rid of a few jobs, knock down a few hangars, and just sell this land for housing.
Well, I don't think that's quite what they've proposed. But, I mean, they have shut the airport down. It's never going to work again. We're never going to see planes flying in and out of there. There is a commercial decision. I mean, I used to live out in Stoke Gifford, and I was a parliamentary candidate for Bristol North West when it included Filton and that area as well. So you know, I have been involved to a certain extent. It is sad to see an airport, a facility like that, which could and historically has helped the industry in that area, the aerospace industry. But the aerospace industry said we don't need it, and I'm afraid, you know, if they said that, that's that, you know, they sold it off. Now let's remember, this is going to be a huge area of much needed housing, and it's going to be an enterprise zone. There's going to be a lot of jobs created there. So you know, let's not think that this is suddenly, you know, the airport going and everything's going to be doom and gloom and there's just going to be a few weeds growing up in the middle of the runway. This is going to be a fantastic new vibrant area for Bristol, for North Bristol or South Gloucestershire if you live up there. So, you know, I think there are positives to it. I'd never want to see it made into a commercial airport. I think that would have been awful for the people of North Bristol, both the noise, the pollution, and the cars and traffic that would have been going in and out of there. So I think it was only ever going to be for British Aerospace, Airbus, and GKN. They've decided they don't want it. It's going to be fantastically regenerated.
I mean, chatting informally to some of the employees at GKN, Rolls-Royce, and places like that, they actually do believe that their factories are going to be closed down because they can't see how aerospace industry can survive without an airport and without a runway.
Well, at the moment, that's not true. There's more investment coming in. There's the aerospace industry is creating jobs in the north of Bristol and the South Gloucestershire area. So, I think that employees are always worried when change happens, and they will express those worries, thinking that this will happen. I do believe the companies will invest in that area, and we will still have a very vibrant aerospace industry in the north.
Martin, which side do you come down on here? Because this is a commercial decision. In this case, it's the Stagecoach boss. In our case, in Filton, it's BAE Systems. They've just decided, well, look, actually, this asset is worth much more if we can sell it for housing.
Well, what we're lacking in Britain, and we've lacked it for a long time, is a serious industrial policy, which means that you've got some kind of planning underpinning what you're doing, which isn't just made on short-term commercial considerations. And I wonder if Filton had been in Japan or Germany, whether they would have closed the airfield. That's all I'll say.
Okay, and something that's just popped up this week as well in the Bristol Post, final story. Avonmouth traveller eviction bid. A councillor calls for patience. This is a Conservative councillor who's urging Avonmouth residents to be patient over delays in evicting travellers from an illegal encampment under the M5. The Bristol Post reported earlier that the council was fighting an injunction which was preventing the eviction of a family who'd been living off West Town Road under the Avonmouth Bridge. Tory councillor Wayne Harvey said an alternative site offered to the travellers was refused because they want a permanent pitch at Ashton, saying, "I fully understand the frustration felt by local people over the time and cost it's taking to resolve this issue." Now, travellers have been around for, I suppose, thousands of years, haven't they? Slowly but surely, they're being sort of moved into local authority sites. What are your thoughts about this one? Because these travellers have gone to court saying, well, look, actually, we've got an injunction saying you can't move us.
Yeah, I know, and I think that's what Wayne is saying. You know, we've got to follow the process of law here, and you know, travellers have rights, but local residents have rights as well, and travellers moving on to patches of ground or even private land close to homes does cause local residents a lot of concern. You know, I think that we need to offer them permanent pitches, and we can't have travellers just pitching up wherever they feel like and bringing their caravans on site. You know, that is not good for local communities.
And what about the travelling lifestyle as a whole, though? Because, I mean, some of these people will say, well, actually, you know, we're part of a tradition in this country of labour that used to move around, and we will stay one place for a few weeks and then we'll move on and work somewhere else.
Yeah, and I think it's a hangover from previous centuries. I don't know very much about the traveller community. You know, they would say they have this particular culture which requires them to do this. I think quite a few of them are now settling down more permanently. I think that's what will happen eventually. At the moment, we're still in the position where these people do move around, do cause some disruption when they pitch up on places.
Martin?
Well, as Alice has said, let's follow the rules here and make sure that they're fair to everybody.
What about the idea, though, that the travelling lifestyle now is proving extremely difficult for travellers to live it? I mean, for centuries, well, like I was saying, well, this has been a normal thing. People can move around and they're working in different places during different times of the year.
One of the problems is that there isn't enough proper sites for them. And because whenever you say we're going to have a permanent site, the residents complain about that. But we do have rules and regulations about this, and the interests of all parts of the community have to be respected. I mean, they've got a legal injunction against the eviction. That's the legal position as it stands. But you can understand that ultimately this isn't satisfactory, and people are going to be put on proper sites with proper facilities, for example, you know, plumbing and drainage.
Okay. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, that was Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, soon to be the city's Lord Mayor, he hopes, and we hope, if he gets re-elected. That's Alistair Watson. After the Murdoch News, a Sunday Times Rich List is out this weekend. But can the mega rich hide their wealth?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, at least 10 people have died and nearly 70 others hurt in two explosions in Kenya. They hit a market in the capital, Nairobi. In the last 24 hours, a number of tour operators have started flying hundreds of British holidaymakers who are in Kenya home. Uhuru Kenyatta is the country's president.
I am aware of what the British government chose to do yesterday, but all I can say is that we in Kenya are committed to this fight. We will do what we can as a government. We will continue to market our country.
Stuart Hall has been found not guilty of 19 charges of rape and indecent assault, but a jury has convicted the former It's a Knockout presenter of one count of assault on a girl aged under 16. Our reporter Becky Johnson says he sat in